From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. In a moment, the wisdom of ancient Egypt invoking the scribes of ancient Egypt. Stand by for that. Next hour, Magic and the Occult with Lon Milo Duquette. Here's what's happening. You need to check your refrigerator because some organic baby spinach is being recalled after random testing found possible salmonella contamination in a finished package of spinach. This according to a recall alert published by the FDA. The sample was taken at a distribution center in Texas. Now, the specific products being recalled are Private Sections Organic Baby Spinach, 5-ounce clamshell with a best buy date of 5/25 this year, distributed now to stores in Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Kansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Montana, New Mexico, Nevada, Oregon, Texas, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. And just 6 months after issuing its latest warning about chicken jerky dog treats made in China, the FDA confirms it has logged more than 900 complaints from pet owners who say their dogs either were sickened or died after eating the treats. Consumers have largely blamed two brands for the reported illnesses, Wagon Train and Canyon Creek Ranch, both produced by Nestle Purina, made in China. Russia tested a new long-range missile that should improve its ability to penetrate missile defense systems. Russia opposes a missile shield the United States and NATO are deploying in Europe, saying it will be able to intercept Russian warheads by about 2018, weakening Moscow's arsenal and upsetting the post-Cold War balance of power. You know, with the use of domestic drones increasing, concerns not just over privacy issues, but also over the potential use of lethal force by unmanned aircraft. Drones have been used overseas, as you know, to target and kill high-level terror leaders, and also are being used along the U.S.-Mexico border in the battle against illegal immigration. But now these drones are starting to be used here at home. The Federal Aviation Administration has allowed several police departments to use drones. Already, one department in Texas considering using rubber bullets and tear gas on its drone. A new smartphone app called SceneTap made a big splash with its recent launch, but not all of the reviews were entirely favorable. The app employs facial detection software and cameras placed strategically in bars and nightclubs to tell users the age and gender makeup of an establishment that they're thinking of visiting. But the problem is that the patrons being scanned by cameras don't necessarily know that they're being monitored. And some privacy advocates call it creepy. Is it an invasion of privacy for your neighborhood watering hole to install cameras and scan your face? Privacy expert Catherine Albrecht with us. Catherine, is it? What do you think?
Well, I think it is, George. You know, when you walk into a bar, I think a bar is a particularly sensitive place because it's a place where you want to unwind, you know, maybe after work, maybe on a weekend, maybe with a couple of friends. And you don't really like the idea of cameras there snapping your photograph and uploading them to who knows where. This particular application, I'm a little bit encouraged because a lot of people have complained about it, so much so that the creators of SceneTap even wrote a letter to the city of San Francisco, which is one of six or seven cities where this has been installed, and actually felt a need to defend themselves to the leaders of the city. That's how upset and angry people are about this. So I think that's good news. It's gotten a lot of high-profile awareness. But what they claim and what they explain, they say, listen, we don't use facial recognition. We could. The technology is out there. They could probably link it up with Facebook and actually call up your whole profile. They say, instead, we use facial detection. And what that does is it tells us the age, you know, our software goes through, it takes your picture, tells the age, tells the gender, and then we post up on, you know, they say that they post up on a page that people can access how many, you know, 18-year-old blondes are in a particular establishment, or I suppose over 21 if it's a bar, you know, how many 30-year-old guys are in there, et cetera, et cetera. And you can log on, you can look at the demographics and make your own choice as to which bar you want to go to. Not only the privacy advocates are upset about this, but a lot of people are saying, hey, you know, this makes women feel like they're being stalked.
Sure.
because a big part of this is trying to figure out, okay, so where are the girls tonight? And if you're just out with the girls to have a good time, the idea also that people are logging on and trying to figure out where the women are kind of turns women into hunted prey.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Oh, that's a good point, Catherine. Thank you so much. Catherine's website's part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. HP, Hewlett-Packard, they're going to cut 27,000 jobs. They need to save billions of dollars in savings by fiscal 2014. 27,000 people. A Pakistani doctor who helped the United States track down Osama bin Laden has been sentenced to 33 years in prison on conspiracy charges against Pakistan. Greg Hunter, USAWatchdog.com. Greg, this is abominable that they'd let this happen to this guy.
We're talking about Shaquille Afridi, and he is a doctor that basically got the DNA that nailed bin Laden. Now, there's some good news here. This is a tribal court. And, you know, they have a constitution in Pakistan, and he gets to defend himself. In this case, he did not get a chance to defend himself. And listen, the State Department, Department of Defense, Panetta, Carl Levin, John McCain on the Defense Committee, they are up in arms. And I think that, that this is not going to stand. He's going to go through hell. He's in the central jail. It's like being in jail, probably like in Mexico or whatever. It's not like, Camp Fed. So, but I think there's going to be a lot of pressure with the State Department. I think Hillary Clinton will ultimately be involved. They are either going to buy his way out, they're going to spring him. This is the guy that helped nail bin Laden. We tracked him for more than a decade. So I just don't think it's going to stand, but he's going to go through, he's being punished. And this is the wider issue here is that this distrust in the Middle East.
That's
this Pakistanis distrust, the U.S. The U.S. has accidentally hit civilians with drone strikes in Afghanistan. We've had soldiers kill NATO troops. I mean, this is a really cloak and dagger situation in the Middle East over there, and that's just a small part of it.
Do we know who got the money, that huge reward on bin Laden?
I do not know that.
No. We got to find that out, Greg, all right?
Okay.
All right. Turn yourself loose on that. Scientists say they've managed to turn patients' own skin cells into healthy heart muscle in labs. Ultimately, they hope this stem cell therapy could be used to treat heart failure patients. That's amazing. European researchers are planning to use new techniques to analyze DNA that could help track the mystery of Bigfoot. In a project announced this week, Oxford University scientists appealed to museum scientists, Yeti aficionados, to share their hair samples thought to be from the ape-like creature. New genetic tests will be done on just a few strands of hair, should be completed within weeks. Even if the sample is judged to come from an unknown species, scientists should be able to tell how closely it is related to other species, including apes or humans. That could be a huge breakthrough in the search for Bigfoot. Up next, invoking the scribes of ancient Egypt, Gloria Taylor Brown joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Gloria Taylor Brown is a university lecturer, healing teacher, mystic, a lifelong student of Egyptian studies, president of Alchemy Arts, which is a national business consultancy company. Her book, Invoking the Scribes of Egypt. Hey, Gloria, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Tell me your interest in Egypt. Truly a fascinating place.
Oh, I've been in love with Egypt since I was 5 years old. I fell in love with Egypt through a book called Mara, Daughter of the Nile, and I was a very precocious reader, and by the time I was five, I was reading books that were all words, and I found this book, and I read it, and I decided that I was a princess of Egypt. In fact, I went home and told my mother that I wasn't really from northern Florida. I was really from Egypt, and she wasn't my mother because I was a princess.
You might have been. You might, again, Egypt holding elections today. They're going to go through some changes. Do you think they'll still be open, Gloria, to tourism? It is a big industry for them, people who want to see the pyramids and the Sphinx.
I think it's a $32 billion a year business for them, and I don't think they're going to shut it down. I think tourism is... They have always treated us with great respect and made sure we are safe and secure, and I think they're going to continue that practice.
What did you think of Zahi Hawass while he was in office?
I'm sure there's bigger egos on the planet. I haven't met them. I have met Zahi Hawass. He was very capable of getting press.
Yes. Yes, he loved what he was doing.
Yes, he did. And I've heard him speak both privately and in groups, and he knows what he's talking about. He is restrictive, and that would be my biggest argument with him, in that he has had a tendency to want to keep information for himself.
Gloria, one of the regions, of course, on this planet, Egypt, where people are just so fascinated with the possibility that these pyramids could have been made from extraterrestrial sources. Nobody knows. I mean, Zahi, when you would bring it up to him, as I would, he would go nuts. He did not want to hear that. You know, it was Egypt, Egypt all the way. But what are your feelings about that?
Well, one of the things that I believe is that, and this is a belief, not a knowledge, of course, is that at some point there was contact with more advanced civilizations. And I find it very difficult. I mean, anyone who's traveled through Egypt, which I'm sure you have as well.
I have not. My dad was born there. I haven't been there.
Oh, you must go. But anyone who has traveled through Egypt and has looked at 200-ton blocks that are cut with such precision has real trouble imagining that that was done by a stone culture, a culture that only had rocks and stones and copper tools.
Well, you can't blame anybody for doubting that, can you?
No, you can't. And whenever you go to the Osirion at Abydos, and you see the flower of life, which is inscribed into the walls of those blocks with such precision. I mean, we're talking about something that we would have difficulty doing with our lasers today.
So what is your gut feeling?
My gut feeling about it is that this is an experiment. We are an experiment. And they're very pleased with how the experiment is turning out.
You think?
I think so. I think that we've been cultured, shall we say. And in that culture, they have created these beings called Homo sapiens. But where we're going is so much more. The capability that is within us is truly Homo divinus. The God in human.
Are you familiar with the work of the late Edward Leeds Scullin from Coral Castle in Florida?
Yes, I am. I'm familiar, not totally, but I do know about it. My friend, I think Jay Wiedner,
yes,
has done quite a bit of work with him.
Here's a guy, frail, 120 pounds, all by himself, moved these stones, huge stones, to build Coral Castle.
Yes, and he never revealed how he did it.
Never did, except one day he did say he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were made.
Well, you know, there's a lot of strange things that come out of Florida. I can say that because I'm from there.
Including alligators.
Oh, yes, and crocodiles. But, you know, it's an interesting place, and it's the culture that comes from there is very different. And in many ways, I feel that it's the sands of northern Florida that caused me to fall in love with the sands of Egypt.
Tell me about your theme here, invoking the scribes of ancient Egypt.
Oh, well, as I was raised in northern Florida by a family of storytellers, I was raised by people who told stories over and over again. That was the way we entertained each other. And I always wanted to encourage my students and the people that I work with to tell their story. And when Normandy Ellis, who is my co-author, and I got together, the idea was that we would bring forth from our tour participants their stories, their sacred biographies, their spiritual biographies. And so we designed a tour based around that whole theory. And so what we had was 17 people who were willing to travel with us and write with us. And after 16 days, we had an 800-page book. And it took us the next year and a half to get it edited down to the mere 300 pages we have now in Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt.
Gloria, for a planet that has done a pretty good job of passing down information from generation to generation, since the days of Jesus, for example, what happened to the lost information from Egypt? This gap where we don't know anything about anything, what happened? Why did it stop? Why didn't it get carried forward? Why didn't it get to the point where we're at a point now where we can say, yeah, our ancient ancestors told us exactly how they were made because it was carried through. We don't have that information. There's a gap there. How come?
Basically the same thing we're doing now in Afghanistan and Iraq. They had people come in that said, we don't need this information. Let's use it for firewood. And so they burned information and they burned the papyrus and they destroyed the stones. I mean, you go there and you see these beautiful stones where people have taken axes to them and chiseled off the information. They've chiseled off the faces. They've stolen the soul of the stones.
So you're saying the information was going to be passed down, it was just destroyed?
I believe with all my heart that the pharaohs of Egypt wanted to have that information passed down. They recorded everything. I mean, from the slightest transaction in the market to the wars and the transactions they had with other countries. And it was volumes and volumes and volumes of information. And I think some of it is still there waiting for us to find it. I mean, like the Nag Hammadi scrolls, the Dead Sea scrolls have been found. I think there's probably more. And in fact, Zahi Hawass himself said that he believed that 90% of what we knew about Egypt is yet to be found out.
What do you think about Edgar Cayce's thoughts about the Hall of Records, one of which, he says, at the base of the Sphinx?
Well, I know that there is a cavern there. They found something. I also know that it's very difficult to get to. But for me, the Sphinx is the gateway. The Sphinx is the guardian of the secrets of Egypt. And it is very interesting whenever you come upon in this magnificent, huge animal or human or whatever it is, and you walk around it and you see the sculpture that has been created there. And somehow, I believe that part of the information of the Sphinx is actually recorded within the stone itself.
If some extraterrestrials helped us, how did they do it? Sound? Do you think sound moved it? What do you think they used?
I think they may have used technology beyond our own capability of understanding. One of the things that I've had experience with in the last few years is working with star beings who have come to this planet through other dimensions. And I think that one of the things that is, as three-dimensional beings, it's very difficult for us to understand the capabilities and the ability of a fourth, fifth, or sixth-dimensional being.
Explain.
Well, we know scientifically, quantum physics, there are probably 10 dimensions. We live in the bottom four three, depending upon how you look at it, if you consider time and space.
Time is one, sure.
Yeah. If you consider time and space a dimension.
Hold on, Gloria. We're going to take this break. We'll come right back with this in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Lon Milo Duquette joins us. We're going to talk about magic, not the kind that David Copperfield performs, something very special. Make sure you're part of that program. And we're with Gloria Taylor Brown. Gloria, you were talking about these other dimensions that we're in, and that there are 10 of them, but I'll let you finish that up.
Well, basically the idea is that there are at least 10 dimensions in the space that we exist in. And we occupy the bottom 3, 4, or 5, depending on how you look at it. The other dimensions layer upon there, and they are also occupied, is what I've been told. And what I've been told by the spirits that I talk with, such as Thoth or Anubis, is that they now exist in these alternate, these higher dimensions, and that for them to slow down enough to talk to us is a huge effort on their part, because they're basically moving so much faster than we do that it's like us trying to talk to rocks. And so they have made this effort to speak through myself and others who bring through the journeys and the information so that people can become transformed. As I said, our goal is to transform into these greater and higher beings that they see as our capability, that they see as our possibility, and to not stay mired in the mud of humanity, which we seem to be very fond of, frankly.
We're in it deep. What do you think of the Mayan calendar day, 2012, here?
I can't answer that, but what I can say is whenever I ask Thoth what is going to happen at the end of 2012, he always answers me the same way. He says 2013. And his answer has been, why do you think that your artificial calendar should have any effect on us? And I believe that the Mayans basically were seeing a calendrical movement of precession, a movement of the stars and the sun and the sky, and their capability. Again, we're talking about lost knowledge. We're talking about wisdom and information that we lost, that it was destroyed by people who didn't understand what it was. I mean, it was literally burned in bonfires. And so we have maybe one or two or three codexes out of the hundreds and hundreds and thousands of codexes that were available.
You say you have a contact, a guide.
Yes.
Who?
I am contacted primarily by Thoth. And Thoth is the Egyptian god or spirit of wisdom. He is the one that laid down the lines for the pyramid to be built. He is the one, he's one of the old gods. He's one of the ones that were the original gods that brought through, and when I say gods, it's because we don't have a word for them that, you know, is capable of understanding. In the Egyptian terminology, they are called netters. And netter was pronounced nature, and it is from that word that we get the word nature. But the netters, the gods of Egypt, were these wise beings that brought information and basically transferred it to the humans that were existing in the Nile Valley. I mean, this is the story they tell on their walls. This is the story they tell in the papyrus.
How do you explain, Gloria, pyramids all over the planet, not just Egypt? They're everywhere.
I don't explain it, but I do know that there is a lot of evidence coming forth that we did have a global marine culture that transferred knowledge from one place to another. That the capabilities, I mean, there is the Pharaoh's boat, which was buried beside the pyramid some 4,500 years ago. And if, when you stand beneath this over 100-foot long boat that was tied together, you can't believe that these people weren't capable of sailing the seas. I mean, I sailed from Alaska to Panama in a much smaller boat.
Well, we still remember Contiki, don't we?
Right. And Contiki was, you know, frankly, it was a barge. It's a miracle he made it anywhere.
Yeah, Thor Heyerdahl.
Yes.
Let's take some calls here. We'll pick it up by going to Matthew in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Welcome to the program. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Yes, I was wanting to ask, ask our guest if she was familiar with E.E. Remus in San Francisco and his work as an Egyptologist.
E.E. Remus. Are you, Gloria?
No, I'm afraid not.
What can you tell us about him?
Well, he just was, an occultist that lived in San Francisco. He died in 2004. And anyway, he just had, he was just somebody that I'd been in contact with, and I was just curious if you
Okay. Did
that name. I know there's several Egyptologists around.
Oh, yeah, there's a handful. And they're all pretty good, aren't they, Gloria?
There are many that are very good. And there are many people who have studied Egypt that wouldn't call themselves Egyptologists. I mean, from John Anthony West to Robert Bovall, both of whom I know, there are many, many people out there that understand the information that we are trying to re-decipher.
What do you think of Christopher Dunn's theory that the Giza power plant is that, a power plant?
I agree with the idea it was a power plant. I'm not sure it's exactly the way Christopher envisions it. And the reason I believe it's a power plant is because when you stand in the so-called King's Chamber, you can feel the electricity on your skin. It's like the pyramid sings to you. And you can sense, besides being under all those millions and millions of tons of rock, you can feel that there's something more here than what I can understand with my limited ability.
We're going to Dearborn, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hey, Rich, go ahead.
Hi. I would like to ask your guest which way she thinks the Sphinx was facing when it was originally carved.
And I'm not sure that face was there in the first place. Was it, Gloria? What do you think?
I doubt it seriously. I think it was either a lion or it was a jackal. And the reason I go with jackal is because the tail is actually that of a jackal, not of a lion. And it has always been facing the eastern horizon. It faces directly where the sun rises at the equinox.
And it was carved out of a structure that was already there, right? A mountain or something?
It was carved out of a rock structure that rises out of the desert. And I know that we absolutely know that it existed far longer than that of the carving, that the enclosure itself is probably in the neighborhood of 10,000 years old. The Sphinx itself is, it's hard for people to understand. They see these pictures of it, and they don't understand exactly how big this thing is.
Oh, it's huge. And it was almost, wasn't it almost buried?
It was buried up to its neck.
Yeah.
It's been buried several times up to its neck. In fact, if it hadn't been buried up to its neck, by now it probably would have eroded away completely.
Now, here's an interesting question. It's not like there wasn't anybody around there after they stopped building it. How did it get allowed to get that much sand to go up that high? Why didn't the people of the era, regardless of when, just keep it down? Isn't that weird?
Well, it's a big structure. I mean, and it's a large hole in the ground, and the head does rise above the plain of the Giza Plateau. And, you know, we have a lot of people that date it from around the time of the pyramids, but
maybe it was supposed to stay buried.
I think it helped it be protected so that we could now see it. Now, one of the problems, of course, now is it is unprotected and it is exposed.
Sure.
And they do limit access to it. So most people never get as close as I've been where I've stood between the paws of the Sphinx.
But what I just don't understand is there were always people living in that region, right? It's not like they disappeared for thousands of years.
No.
So why didn't they keep the thing uncovered?
Well, it
isn't that weird?
It probably wasn't a priority. You know, you were talking about a pretty dark period.
Well, and it takes years for the sand to get that high, doesn't it? It doesn't happen in a year, does it?
No, but it could probably happen in about 10.
And so if they don't do anything, it gets higher and higher and higher.
Right.
If I was running that area, I would have said, clean that. You know, take that sand away. Let's go to Casey, Boise, Idaho, west of the Rockies. Hi, Casey.
Hey, George. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Great. I love your show. I've been a long-time listener. And,
you, Casey.
Love you guys. Anyways, I'll get right to my question. I've heard a bunch of rumors that they found like traces of DMT dust on the inside of the pyramids. I was wondering if your guests knew anything about that.
What do you think about that, Gloria? Derivatives of special hallucinogenics.
I don't know about DMT. I do know that there's some evidence that they found some types of drugs. I also know that they found some evidence of corn, which does not grow in that region.
Okay, we go to Sean in Little Chute, Wisconsin. First-time caller. Hi, Sean.
How's it going, George?
Good, Sean.
I've been listening for a while. It's just the first time I've got a chance to call in.
Okay, great.
And I wanted to answer somewhat of a question that you had posed, Gloria, and she kind of went into but didn't really give a whole lot of information about, like, where did all the information go? Well, we've got pretty documented evidence where some of it went to, for example, the burning of the library in Alexandria. Even though it was an accident, you know, there's 40,000 or 40 or 1,000 or more books that had been amassed as kind of a repository of the world's information that just,
you know, it's gone
within a day, points out of existence.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could equate it to, like, if your computer gets a virus now, you tell somebody you had a virus, but everything that you had there just completely disappeared.
It's gone. That's right. And there was no backup.
And, you know, actually, they found recently what they believe to be the ruins of the Library of Alexandria. So who knows what information we're going to pull out about Egypt from there.
Was it buried? Was it buried, Sean?
It was buried, but it's the ruins of. And then another thing was the pyramids. You know, you'd mentioned sea travel and whatnot, and, you know, it's through basic archaeology and stuff. Like, we've come to find out, and there's, I wouldn't call it a well, you know, documented, but the Japanese discovering the United States anywhere from 50 years before Columbus got here to 1,000. You know, it's through archaeological evidence was discovered.
Lots of people came here before Columbus. I'm convinced of that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. But it's just that it takes time to dig this stuff up to actually find it. So, you know, like what you were saying about Sahihua, you know, the stuff's there. We just got to find it.
That's true. And what do you think came first, Gloria, the Sphinx or the pyramids of Giza?
I'm absolutely convinced that the Sphinx predates the pyramids by several thousand years.
Wow.
And I'm not sure. I mean, it predates it probably by several million years if you just consider the fact that it is hard rock in a sandstone sea. And but it was I believe, and based upon the evidence I have read, I believe that you're looking at something that was probably done around, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 BC.
You know, I think it would be great if the Sphinx was a million years old, wouldn't it?
It would be lovely. And I'm sure the rock itself is. It could be, but I don't have any evidence of that. What I do know is that it is a tremendously powerful gateway. And if we use that gateway properly, we have the ability to travel to the stars.
Let's go next to Kate in West Hollywood, California. Hey, Kate.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was wondering if your guest had any information. I'd heard recently that they think there may be a chamber under the Sphinx, which had been predicted by Edgar Cayce, and wondered if she knew anything about that.
She sure does. We talked about it a little while ago, Kate. There is a chamber that's been discovered. Richard Schrock was able to find it with some special testing equipment, though we were never able to get down there. Why don't we go down there, Gloria?
Because the Egyptian government doesn't let us.
But why wouldn't they do that? Well, I agree, they won't let us. But
why don't they allow us to do ceremony in the temple?
They're hiding something.
Why won't they let us? Why won't they let us bring in information gathering techniques that will allow us to get more information? I have a friend who's a paleogeologist who was doing some research on the Giza Plateau, and they forced him to, you know, all of the research he had to do had to be done right there on the plateau. And as he said, I can't do most of it here. The equipment I need is not here. It's in university laboratory. And so he's sitting there, you know, kind of trying to figure out the age and the information from the geology. And they're incredibly, incredibly restrictive as to what it is we're allowed to understand.
Is it possible Zahi's already, dug up the Hall of Records and just never told anybody?
Totally.
That is possible.
Oh, yes.
And whatever was in there, he took.
Well, I wouldn't say he took it, but I would say that...
took it out, I mean.
Yeah, I would say that he probably has future books in mind.
Yeah, he may. Speaking of books, where do we get yours? Invoking the Scribes.
Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt. It's available through Inner Traditions and Amazon. It's also available on my website. You can go to Hathor's Mirror. I'm very proud of the book and the way that it turned out. It has colored pictures in it, but you too can travel through Egypt.
You did a good job. Thank you, Gloria. Appreciate you being on the program. Up next, as I mentioned, Lon Milo Duquette joins us. We're going to talk about magic, and poof, we'll make Will disappear, who's filling in for Tom, just like that. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.